Good morning. This book called Making Love with Light has been done or written by John Dido-Luries. He's the, he was the Zen teacher at Zen Mountain Monastery and also a teacher in this lineage, in the White Plum lineage. So I'm going to do a brief lead-in because there's a part of this this book which is just, to me, stunningly beautiful that I want to read to you. So there's a famous collection of works that are written by Dogen, Zen Master Dogen Roshi. And he lived in the 13th century. And the Shobo Genzo is also known as the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. And that generally refers to the Dharma, specifically the realization of Buddha. And this Shobo Genzo is considered one of the most profound expressions of Zen. If you read it with a mind that tries to capture meaning, with a mind that categorizes or seeks understanding in the conventional way, you won't understand it at all. It'll be totally confusing because it's been written in what is referred to as Dogenese. Dogen has his own unique way of writing. And if you, and once you work with it, and you sort of catch on of how he speaks, that he's speaking to us intuitively, not intellectually, it's really quite beautiful. I can't say that I've mastered it, but I keep trying. So there's a Japanese term for Shobo Genzo, which is Sansu, Sansujyo. And its meaning is nature, water, and Buddhism. And Dogen believed that the way to understand is through the experience of the natural world. And in the Shobo Genzo, there's a chapter entitled Mountains and Rivers. Sometimes it's referred to as Mountains and Waters. And in this chapter, Dogen refers to mountains walking. And this, of course, is Dogenese. If you think about it, right, if I say mountains walking, I think probably most of us will, immediately stop and say that makes no sense. Mountains don't walk. What does that mean? Mountains walking. So if you think about it, you see a mountain in the distance, it seems permanent. It seems incredibly grounded, pardon the play on words, powerful, solid, this thing called a mountain. Seems like something that has not changed for centuries. But when we enter the mountain, both literally and figuratively, when we enter the mountain, we realize the incredible activity of that mountain. All different types of flowers and grasses and reeds constantly coming into existence and going out of existence. Birds proliferate the mountain, all different kind of birds, which have their own life cycle, their own way of surviving, their own way of reproducing. The waters that flow in the mountain have all different types of fish, particularly where the water flows out of the mountain down into the valley. All different types of fish, all types of insects, and of course, all types of animals. And each one of these has its own life cycle, and each one of these interacts with its environment, even down to a cellular level. And this action, if you think about it, if you just imagine the interreaction of all these millions of different things, this is the mountain walking, right? It's not this thing that's fixed, that's solid. It's actually alive. So John Dido-Luries, who died about 5 years ago, as I said, was the abbot of the Zen Mountain Monastery. And as well as being a Zen teacher, he was a photographer. And I would encourage you to seek out, I guess you could Google it, his photography. And most of his photography is pictures of nature. And in many of his books, he combines the pictures with words, either his own words, quotes from Dogen, haiku, all sorts of different things. But these pictures are stunning. They're the most, probably to me, the most beautiful nature pictures I have ever seen. And again, many of them are expressed in Dogenese, Right? Some of them are very simple pictures of birds and trees and shadows, but others of them require a relationship with them that's intuitive. So this book that I have here, Making Love with Light, is an example of that. And in the beginning, there's a chapter, a brief chapter, which I'm going to read a lot of, because to me it's just stunning. And introducing the chapter is a quote from Ihe Dogen. An ancient sage has said, "Mountains are mountain and rivers are rivers." The meaning of these words is not that mountains are mountains, but that mountains are mountains. The meaning of these words is that mountains are mountains, but that mountains are mountains. Therefore, we should thoroughly contemplate these mountains. When we thoroughly contemplate the mountain, this is mountain training. Such mountains and rivers themselves spontaneously become wise one and sages. Now that's not like reading a paragraph from the New York Times, no matter how literary it might be. This is Dogenese. So I'm going to read to you from Sacred Space, which I think talks about this walking. It's early morning, and I've been out for an hour already, sitting on a small rise surrounded by tall grasses and budding swamp willow saplings, waiting for the first light, the first songs, the early stirrings of day. Hearing splashing in the water nearby, on hands and knees, I slowly weave my way through the weeds to get a better view. Below me, on a lazy stretch of a meandering stream, a female wood duck and her gaggle of hatchlings are feeding. I inch forward, trying not to be abrupt in my movements. Light readings out of the way. The camera is ready. The birds are not aware of my presence. As I point my camera, prepared to make an exposure, there is a sudden burst of activity, lots of scurrying. I look up from the viewfinder. The ducklings are gone. Their mother seems to be alone in the water, quacking loudly and wildly, flopping around, acting wounded. From the corner of my eye, I notice a flash of black fur sliding swiftly across the water, and the wood duck deftly moves out of reach of a hungry mink, and another quicksilver lunge from the mink, and the duck flies a few feet further away, then falls into the water again, continuing to draw the mink towards her. The mink's blood must be boiling. It strikes again. The duck escapes just in the nick of time. This dance unfolds down a quarter of a mile of the winding stream that curves towards the river. Finally, both duck and mink disappear from my sight, and I realize that I have been holding my breath. As I exhale, the mother duck arrives from the opposite direction and alights on the still water where the whole episode began. She makes a few quiet sounds, and in an instant, the ducklings materialize from among the weeds. With the mother leading, the ragged column waddles away and dissolves into the deep cover of the wetlands. Somewhere along the riverbank, a confused mink is sniffing and searching for the easy prey that got away. So Dida Lurie says, "For over 20 years, I have lived amid the Catskill Mountains, streams, and wetlands. I have witnessed the life and death struggles that are a daily occurrence here, and photographed the creatures that are born and die in this wilderness, contemplating their changes and cycles, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, and smelling the wonder of this place. With these creatures, I receive a gift of sharing this space with them. Contemplating their changes and cycles, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling the wonder of this place." That's entering the mountain. Seeing, feeling, touching, smelling. That's entering the mountain. It's entering completely. And it's not just observing. It's being the activity of the mountain itself. In the center of the wetlands sits a long pond, a stretch of water almost a half mile long, 200 feet wide, and 12 feet at its deepest. The pond is both spring-fed and filled by water that finds its way through the riprap of the upstream dam that the Conservation Department engineers designed as part of their attempt to manicure the flow of the river. The beaver population builds its own dams downstream and maintains the pond at a healthy level, even during severe droughts. The shallow end of the pond empties into a winding stream that eventually finds its way back to the river. Long Pond has a robust variety of fish, pickerel, sunfish, bass, catfish, minnows, and an occasional trout after the swollen river runs over the dam. Overflow from the pond crisscrosses the wetlands and the island, filling innumerable depressions, ruts, and channels, keeping the ground juicy. An assortment of frogs, water snakes, turtles, and aquatic insects reside in this matrix of bogs, swamps, and puddles. Attracted by all this life, ducks, geese, great blue heron, green heron, and the eastern bittern wade, and fish the area daily. Fox, coyote, black bear, mink, weasel, bobcat are in turn attracted by the presence of these birds. Osprey, bald eagle, owls on the prowl, the skies overhead. The river, wetlands, and pond are at the edge of the western slope of a mountain that has a circumference of over 11 miles at its base. Since this site is one of a few places in the area that provides easy access to flowing water with protective, dense forest cover, virtually every creature living on the mountain sooner or later finds its way into this space. Let me just check in with you. I know I'm reading a lot. Is this insufferable, or are you with me? It's no, you're not with me, or it's okay. Okay. There are times when this landscape, brimming with life, turns into a wasteland. Rampaging spring floods tear down trees along the riverbanks, churn the channel all the way to its muddy bottom, scouring out the pond until all vegetation and living creatures have been swept away. All of life appears to be sucked out of the wetlands, now a scene of desolation. But in a very short time, life returns. Animals carry seeds in their fur and scat. Fish eggs clinging to the feet of wading water birds are deposited in the pond. The wind sweeps in the clouds of insects. By midsummer, the environment has rebounded and the wilderness is pulsating with life again. You know, here's this, the wonderful impermanence, right? Nothing stays the same. It's constantly changing in a variety of ways. It's one of the hearts of Zen, is this impermanence. And, you know, a lot of times we think of impermanence, we take it personally and we worry about our own life and death, which is true. We are born and we do die. But this is an expression of life and death which is absolutely beautiful and gives us a totally different understanding of being born and dying, I think. So he returns at twilight. Back in the woods at twilight, as I am walking from my cabin, my steps are careful, with short checking pauses, so as not to startle the wildlife. A beaver splashes in the pond. Despite my best efforts to remain unnoticed, my movements have telegraphed my presence. A deer snorts in the encroaching darkness. I can hear it crashing through the thicket as it moves deeper into the woods away from me. I am in awe of the incredible communication system of the wilderness, the inherent intelligence of the wilderness. Although I am being very quiet, in a short time virtually every creature that is afoot within a mile radius of where I stand knows of my presence. Every movement is felt and relayed by birds and beasts. The crow tells it to the jay, and the jay tells it to the kingfisher, the duck, and the deer. Sitting by the pond when someone enters the woods, I am aware of their whereabouts by listening to the forest. Within seconds, the message that they are on their way is passed through the little patch of trees. All of the animals understand this wild language, even my very domesticated dog. Immediately he perks up and looks in the direction of the sounds. He waits for confirmation through visual sightings or a scent before starting his racket of barking and carrying on. Isn't this communication? Isn't this intelligence? Mountains are the entire natural realm. Rivers are the entire natural realm. They permeate the 10 directions. The self is the entire natural realm. The mountains and rivers I'm talking about are not mountains and rivers of the poet, naturalist, or biologist. They are not the mountains and rivers of geography, geolatry, or geomancy. They are the mountains and rivers of true nature, wild and unbounded. They are the sacred space itself. As I make my way back to the far end of the pond to await the moonrise, only a blue glow remains in the evening sky. Once each year, a moon rises at precisely the right place to send a silvery sheen down the very center of the pond. And tonight is the night. Ahead, I hear commotion in the undergrowth, then wild splashing. Whatever is moving there is noisier and bigger than the beaver or a doe. Peering into the darkness, I see the form of a large black bear directly across from me, shaking off the pond water. He rears up on his hind legs to get a better look at me. He is about as tall as I am, with twice the bulk. We stand there poised, staring at each other and trying to understand this meeting. He with his wild brain, and me with a cultivated one. After a few moments, he gives a little huff, turns tail, and goes crashing into the wood. I continue to the pond's end. Settling myself at the western edge of the water, I can already see the full hunter's moon rising to the top of the tree line. Magically, a long streak of silver light suddenly flows down the length of the pond, almost reaching my feet. Although the air is still and the water's surface like glass, in the moonlight I can see the pond quivering with the life it contains. It breathes in the cool night air like a giant reclining figure with a luminous spine and a shadowy head of pine and willows. The coyotes begin singing their night song, the song of the hunter. The moon belongs to them. So that are the mountains and waters, the mountains and rivers, walking. That is walking. Thank you.